So on that note, I'm just going to introduce Kevin. There's nothing special about Kevin. He'll tell you that. But on a serious note, I was in a treatment center in Calgary, and I went to a meeting, Shipwreck at Sunset, 9:30 on a Friday? Kevin was there, and he was sharing, and they told me if I didn't get a sponsor in the treatment center I was in, they're going to kick my ass out. So I was like, okay, I got to have a sponsor. So I asked Kevin, and, I'll let him tell the rest of that story, but in short, he was instrumental in getting me involved in the steps, working the steps, studying the book, living the principles, and trying to be a better person. And he's got a special place in my heart. And there's a lot of people that are not doing what they say they're doing. And Kevin is an example of AA that anyone can look up to, whether you've got 48 years or 4 days, right? In my opinion. And he devotes his life to sponsoring men and to putting on big book studies and doing the stuff that I aspire to do. And it's an honor and a privilege to be a part of a roundup committee and to be of service to all you people. And it's an honor and a privilege to introduce my friend Kevin to come and speak on a Sunday morning. Thank you.
Love you too, buddy. Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Kevin Olson. I'm an alcoholic. And it's a tremendous honor and a tremendous privilege to be here this morning. There's so many people that I want to acknowledge and that I want to thank. First of all, I know that the committee for the Grand Prairie Roundup this year is relatively new and has taken on a big responsibility this year. And Clint and Riley and everyone else who's on the committee, I just want to give them a round of applause. You've done an outstanding job this weekend. And I know it has not been easy this weekend. I know talking with Riley all weekend, there's been some stuff happen this weekend. You know, I know Bev's flight was delayed, and I know my flight was delayed. I know I was delayed. You know, a funny thing happened to me on the way here. I get to the airport in Calgary, and everything's going great. And I think to myself, man, I'm getting good at traveling. I've got this kind of figured out. You know, I've traveled for work. I've traveled to Houston. I've traveled to Dallas. I'm starting to get this really well figured out. You know, it's almost too easy. And I get to the gate, and they look at my boarding pass, and they look at my driver's license, and they point out to me that my birthday was 5 days ago, and on my birthday, my driver's license expired. And they did not let me on the plane. And so I had to call Riley and eat a big, big, big piece of humble pie. And explain to him that I was going to be late. I was delayed, and there was nothing to do. There was no way around it. Transport Canada was not negotiable. And, I know that there's some of you out there right now thinking, well, should have checked his license, right? Somebody asked me yesterday if I had identified what defect of character it was that allowed me to let my license expire, right? I get it. I know. I also know there's some of you out there right now thinking, man, I need to check my license. And I also know that there's some of you out there thinking, man, I'd just be happy if I could get my license back. I'm very glad to be here. I'm very glad to be here. And as soon as I arrived, I want to thank Jamie, and I want to thank Carolyn, and I want to thank Jalen, and I want to thank Bailey for opening your house to me. And I want you to know, Jamie, from the moment that I got here and I met you, I knew I was okay. I was here in AA with you guys. I had that feeling. And I sat down with Jamie and Carolyn in their home. They invited me into their home, let me stay in their home, you know? And we stayed up and we talked for 2 hours about recovery, about alcoholism, about recovery, about Al-Anon. It's a family disease, family recovery, right, Norma? I want to thank the other speakers this weekend as well. Bev, I really wish I would have heard you. I really wish I could have been here. I blame Transport Canada. I'm always blaming somebody else. It's part of my nature. Norma, outstanding job yesterday. Just a brilliant, brilliant Al-Anon talk. Al-Anon has a special place in my heart. Al-Anon probably saved my family and quite literally probably saved my father's life. Behind my addiction and my alcoholism and my recovery, my father went into a deep, deep, deep dark depression. And Al-Anon saved my family, saved my father's life. And I have due respect to Al-Anon and always will. Round of applause for all the Al-Anons in the room today. Aaron did an outstanding job last night. Really, man. Really, Aaron. I want to say that. Just a consummate AA speaker. One of the best that I've heard. And I know that that's probably not an easy story for you to tell all the time. And I want to thank you for coming and sharing your heart with us and taking us through your experience and sharing that with us so that we can grow. And that we can see the evidence and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in your life and share it with you and see it in our lives as well. Thank you. Just as Aaron did last night, I'm going to read a little bit of the book to get myself centered. Some of the people here today have asked me to, you know, sign their books as a memento and memory of this weekend, and I always sign page 25. Page 25 is my favorite part in the book, and I'm going to read a couple different passages today. What I want to read right now is this. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other was to accept spiritual help. My story in AA has not been an easy one. I want to let you know I do not have a linear AA story. Okay? I'm not a guy who came to AA and got it. I know that there are many who do. And it's just not my experience. I want to ask tonight, can I just see a show of hands? Anyone here in their first year of recovery right now? Yeah, a round of applause, you guys. That's so brilliant. I'm so glad that you're here, and I know that there's many people here from NAC, the Northern Addiction Center. Is that right? Yeah. Some guys and gals actually living in treatment right now that are here, and I know all about that. I toured and audited many different treatment centers in my life, and I want to start out like I'm gonna talk about my story, obviously, but I believe that there are some things that I was around AA for years, going to meetings, that I just, there were some pieces of information that I didn't get. Now, I'm not saying that they weren't available. I'm just saying that I didn't get them. Okay? For a while, there was a point in my recovery where I was convinced that, Alcoholics Anonymous in Calgary was trying to kill me until we came and we brought the big book, blah, 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 that whole thing. The truth is, for many years of my recovery, if you had a big book under your arm, I ran away from you. Right? I didn't want to know it. I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I just wanted to go to meetings and, stay sober and that was going to be okay. And for me, it wasn't until I absolutely surrendered, not just to the problem, not just to alcohol, but I had to surrender to the solution. And there is a big difference for me. So some of you were here for the foundation meeting yesterday. I'm going to talk about you. You can, if you were here for the foundation meeting yesterday, you can go to sleep for about the next 10 minutes. Okay? Because I'm just going to share some more stuff, some similar stuff. Because listen, I was around AA for many, many years. Before I had some just basic dots connected. You know, Bev and I were talking about just connecting these dots in terms of AA history, but also in terms of what's wrong with me. The three things that every alcoholic needs to know in order to achieve recovery in AA. I need to know what the problem is. I need to know what the solution is. And I need to have a program of action that I can take to connect to that solution. The first thing, if you're new here tonight and nobody's told you, please let me share this with you, what my problem is. My problem is what Dr. Silkworth outlines in this book, in the chapter of The Doctor's Opinion. He calls it the grave nature of alcoholism. I have a physical allergy to alcohol. And that physical allergy manifests itself in a phenomenon of craving. Phenomenon of craving for more alcohol once I start drinking. The more I drink, the more that I want. The drunker I get, the drunker I want to get. That is my experience with alcohol. You know, there's some particular activities that only alcoholics ever participate in. You guys willing to do a little audience participation this morning? Show of hands. Who here has ever bought off sales after the bar closed? Show of hands. There is only one group of people on the planet that need to go buy more alcohol after the bar closes. And that is people in the grips of a phenomenon of craving beyond their control. I've bought off sales many, many times in my life. Okay? Because I needed, the more that I drank, the more that I want. I have this unusual relationship with alcohol. Once I start, I cannot stop. Let me ask you another question. And again, this is something that is only relative to alcoholics. See, I'm the guy at 5 a.m. when the party's over and all the booze is gone. I will walk around and I will drink the bottoms of leftover beers. Okay? Now, here's a trivia question. What would I inevitably get in my mouth when I tipped up a bottle of beer like that? These are my people. If you knew the answer to that question, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Raise your hand if after the cigarette bite you finish the rest of the beer. Yep. But you know what? That's not the problem. That's not the real problem. In fact, the biggest problem that I have are the other two areas of the problem, of the problem itself. Physical allergy, mental obsession. See, because no matter how many times I got into trouble behind drinking and swore off and swore, I'm never going to do this again, it's never going to happen to me again, that's it, I'm done, I'm through forever. Over some period of time, some period of sobriety, I would inevitably have an insane thought. I wouldn't have a drink, I would have a thought. And the thought would say something to the effect of, it's going to be okay, man. I'm just going to go. For me, it was never one. I'd never lied to myself to the extent that I was going to have one drink. I knew it was never one. I'm going to have six drinks. I'm just going to have six drinks. Just six. No big deal. Just catch a buzz. Take the edge off. It'll be fine. Right? And 4 days later, I'd be slamming my head again on the table saying, how did this happen? How did I let this happen? I had this insane thought. I could not overcome. It's an absolute mental blank spot. The delusion, the illusion. In the chapter more about alcoholism, Bill describes it in a whole bunch of different ways. At base, he is talking about the same thing. The thought that precedes the first drink. See, I thought insanity, the insanity of alcoholism, I thought for years, meant the crazy things that I did when I was drinking. Right? Isn't that the insanity of alcoholism? And I would actually bring up the topic insanity at meetings, in those three topic disgusting meetings. I would bring up the topic of insanity so I could hear your funny war stories. But that's not the insanity of alcoholism. The insanity of alcoholism for me is that at some point I have no mental defense and I'm going to do all those same things again when I pick up the first drink, and I have no mental defense against that. The other problem is the spiritual sickness. All of that, physical allergy, mental obsession, is all being fueled by this spiritual sickness. deep within me. And when I was 12 years old, I was not well. I was scared, tense, nervous kid. In school, I remember many times, if I got any grade less than an A, I would openly start crying in class. I was an only child. I still am an only child. Very, very lonely only child. In fact, Dr. Bob, in his story, Dr. Bob's Nightmare, talks about being an only child and how he believed that being an only child engendered the selfishness which would later play such an important role in bringing on his alcoholism. And I was angry. I was an angry, angry, angry 12-year-old kid. I was getting bullied at school, and I would have terrible, terrible fantasies about getting back the guys who were bullying me at school. And I was just sick. Sick 12-year-old kid. Now, if you would have asked me, Kevin, what's wrong? I don't think my answer would have been, well, you know, I think I'm a little spiritually sick right now. I'm feeling a little spiritually off. Okay, but I believe today that that's precisely what was wrong with me. This deep spiritual sickness, this deep spiritual malady inside of me. And one night, in a pickup truck, with a bunch of friends, driving out to a farm party, listening to Metallica's Enter Sandman for the first time, 12 years old, somebody handed me a bottle of Rockaberry wine cooler. 2 liter. And as many of us talk about, I had, at that moment, a transformational experience. I experienced that night drinking that Rockaberry wine cooler and anything else I could get my hands on that night. I experienced emotions and feelings that I did not know were available to me. I experienced a level of freedom and a level of well-being unlike anything I had felt up to that point in my life. And I became incredibly thirsty. And of course, that night I was running around stealing drinks from everyone, getting anything I could get my hands on. I remember I was wearing this white shirt and drinking Paralyzer, like right out of a milk carton, and spilling it all over myself and just howling at the moon, man. loving every minute of it, right? And that physical allergy kicked in like crazy from the very, very beginning. First time I drank. Absolutely, I know today. And what I didn't know at the time is that that was an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I didn't know that until many years later when I came to AA. And it was even after many years in AA when I finally sat down and did a Joe and Charlie Big Book study and started to learn what was actually wrong with me, to start to read the doctor's opinion and start to understand this physical allergy, that reaction that I had when I was 12 years old was abnormal. It doesn't happen that way for everyone. You know? Like Clancy says, sometimes a lot of people take a drink and it goes bloop, does nothing. Right? We don't understand that. I didn't understand that. That for normal drinkers, there's very little effect. For a guy like me, when I take a drink, it is like coming home. It was the best thing that I ever experienced in my life. And I have another memory of that night. And this is a memory that was to follow me for the rest of my life, throughout my drinking career. Was late that night, I got the sense that the party was starting to shut down. And they were turning the music off, and they were putting the booze away. And they were getting ready to leave, and I knew that tomorrow I was going to have to go back to feeling the way that I felt before. I was going to have to go back to being that other guy. And I made a decision, consciously, right then. I will do anything I can to get as much of that stuff as I can in me for the rest of my life, and I'll do anything. It was the best thing I ever felt in my life. The other thing is I experienced no consequences from that night. There was no trouble. No trouble at all. Stayed at my buddy's place, went home the next day. It's like nothing happened. It was fine. It was miraculous. It was the best thing I ever had. So one of the other great things about being an only child is that I had no brothers or sisters around to watch what I was doing. Okay? And I was what's known as a latchkey kid, which means both my parents worked, which means I had a lot of time at home alone by myself. And my parents had an amazing liquor cabinet. Very, very extensive liquor cabinet, okay? My parents are social people and they like to entertain. By no means am I trying to imply that my parents have a drinking problem at all. In fact, they are disgustingly moderate drinkers. Let me give you an example. One time I went to a hotel. My dad was in town visiting. And I went to his hotel room, and I was in AA at this point, and I went, and my dad was having a rye and coke. Now, let me explain to you, first of all, how my father has a rye and coke. He gets a glass, and he gets a couple of ice cubes, and he gets a little shot glass, and he pours out exactly 1 ounce of rye, and he pours that into the glass, and then he fills the rest with Diet Coke. Right? It's like, what are you using a shot glass for? It just doesn't matter. So he had a couple drinks, and I noticed that. And then we went out to the restaurant, and I ordered a Diet Coke, and my dad ordered a Coke. And I noticed that. And I said, "Dad, you're not going to have another drink?" He said, "Ah, I don't really like the way rye and Cokes taste in restaurants. You know, they use cheap rye, and I don't really like the way the Coke tastes. I might have another drink later, but I'm okay right now." I thought, no, I'm adopted. It's gotta be, right? My parents are normal drinkers by any stretch of the imagination. I come from people who are normal drinkers. But I did not drink their alcohol normally. And I got into that liquor cabinet as soon and as hard as I could. And by the time I was 14 years old, I was drinking daily. And I would take, call it garbage mix or whatever you want. I'd take a little bit of vodka and a little bit of whiskey and a little bit of Drambuie and a little bit of Amaretto and a little bit of whatever it was and put it all together and drink that down as hard as I could and then go to the medicine cabinet and open it up and whatever pills said do not take with alcohol may cause drowsiness, I would, take 10 of those and go to school. That's how I was living. That was my high school career. That's how I was at that point. You know, I was always kind of exposed to AA. I always knew AA was kind of around. My mom is a therapist, which was interesting. I'm here to tell you that if being able to learn how to express your feelings enabled recovery from alcoholism, I would have recovered a long time ago. I was able to sit around at kitchen tables with my parents and discuss therapy and different therapy modalities and feelings and all of that stuff. That was not for me what I needed in terms of recovery from alcoholism, right? Anything short of a spiritual awakening and I am doomed to die an alcoholic death. That's what it was. That's what it took for me. I had to find a spiritual recovery. So my mom, being a therapist and I knew about AA from an early age. And all throughout, my story today, you're going to hear other times, many other times, talking about people in AA that came and touched my life, even though I may not have stayed sober. And I need to remember that because I work with a lot of people. I'm very privileged and grateful to work with a lot of people, and they don't always stay sober. But maybe I left them at least with a positive impression of who we are in Alcoholics Anonymous so that when they were ready, when I was ready to come back, my mind was filled with positive memories of AA. So I always knew about AA, and I remember standing in the kitchen one morning on my way to school with a bottle of vodka, tipping it back, taking a drink, thinking, I'm probably going to end up in AA someday. But not today. And so that's how I spent my high school career. I spent my high school career drinking every morning. I remember in a health class one day, they actually had a guy from AA come and talk to our high school class. And it was, I noticed that because I had been drinking that morning already. And I remember him coming and talking about, I drank a case of beer before I went out to the party. And then I had to go party. And he was talking about the last night that he relapsed. And everyone in my class was like aghast that you would drink a whole case of beer before going out to the party. And I just remember thinking, like, this is my kind of guy. Right? And all through high school, I knew that there was some kind of a problem. I knew that what I was doing wasn't normal, but it hadn't become a real problem yet. I was at that point still very functional, and throughout high school, I mean, I did extremely well. I was third in line for valedictorian, and I was school president that year, and I was on the peer support team, which was also bizarre. There were many times where I was counseling people who needed to get to ADAC or whatever it was, and like I had to go back and look at the notes from last time because I couldn't remember, what I was doing. I'm 16 years old, And I kept on like that, for a lot of us, there is a point at which we cross over that invisible line from functional hard drinking into just out of control alcoholism. For me, that happened after I graduated high school. After I graduated high school, three things happened in about a span of a month that for me there was no coming back from. And those three things were, I went to university, moved out of my parents' house. Two, I went through a breakup of a high school relationship and I had a lot of resentment and hurt feelings about that and whatnot. And then the third was that I turned 18. I was actually legal to drink now. And if there was ever going to be a time where you let a dog off a leash, that was it, man. Let me tell you. As soon as I knew that you could, I remember like it's like coming to like, wait a minute, you mean if I have money, I can go to any liquor store, any bar, anytime I want and get anything I want? Like, I don't have to deal with bootleggers anymore. I don't have to deal with my friends' older brothers ripping me off to get more booze. I don't have to steal booze from my parents anymore. That's it. I can get, like, yeah, that's the deal. And I went to pieces very, very quickly. And I was in university in a town, Lethbridge, I guess you guys know probably. And I was in Lethbridge in university. And in the second semester, I remember coming out of a blackout, and I was like 3 weeks into the semester, and I hadn't even darkened the door of a classroom yet. I didn't even have like the syllabus for the courses. I hadn't got my textbooks yet, and I knew I was in trouble. There was not going to be really any way out of this. And I didn't know what to do. And as God would have it, I got a phone call, and the phone call was from my buddy Matt, and Matt was a drummer in a band, a punk rock band, Medicine Hat. I've known those guys for a long time. They know that I play guitar, and they had just signed a record deal, and they were going on tour, and their bass player had just quit. And did I want to drop out of university and join their punk rock band and tour around Canada? Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And that's what I did. That's what I did, and I discovered very quickly an alcoholic's three favorite words: free liquor tab. Hey, band drinks for free, man. And even at that point, I think I had some idea of this physical allergy to alcohol, because I had to try really hard not to drink before the show. If I drank before the show, then all bets were off. So I had to not drink before the show. We'd go play the show, and then after the show, whatever would happen. I mean, you can imagine 5 19-year-olds touring around in a van across Canada in a punk rock band filled with, tour support money. It got pretty gnarly. All right. And, as it turned out, believe it or not, I got kicked out of that band. And, what I got kicked out of the band for was not the way that I drank or not the way that I was, indulging other commodities. I got kicked out of that band for drinking and driving. I got kicked out of that band for my belligerent refuel and inability to stop myself from drinking and driving. In fact, I think I suffer from a physical allergy to drinking and driving. When I start drinking, for whatever reason, and I know there's some of you in here as well, we've talked about this, I talked about this with a couple of people, I want to immediately start driving. I don't know why that is. And the guys in the band just basically said, you know what, We're done with you, man. We're done. We don't want to be associated with someone who's going to do that. You're going to kill somebody. You're going to kill yourself. And we just don't want to have anything to do with it. And that's it. So they kicked me out of that band. And I tried to go back to university, and I tried to go back to school, and I was living in my parents' house, and things became really, really gross. Really, really gross in my parents' house, and became very, very sick. And I was speaking about my father earlier. He went into a deep, dark depression. He didn't know what to do with his son, his beloved son, that was dying in the basement, and it was destroying my parents' marriage and their relationship, and ultimately they decided that they had to ask me to leave. And so I left, and I moved in. I moved into a house in Medicine Hat, this little flop house, with three guys named Lucas, Ben, and Monkey. That's a true story, absolutely true. In fact, years later, I met Monkey in a treatment center in recovery. And Lucas and Ben and Monkey, when I was in grade 9, they were like the bad kids. I was never going to be like those kids, right? 5 years later, I'm living in a house with Lucas, Ben, and Monkey, and they are throwing me out because I'm out of control. And I certainly was. I was very, very sick. Lucas made his own homemade wine. And when I moved in there, he had 200 bottles of fortified homemade wine under his stairs, and he told me to help myself. And I got as physically sick, I think, as a 19, 20-year-old man can get. And I actually started getting wine sores on my body, terrible rashes coming through my skin, just not a good place. And one night, you know, it's not an unusual story for people like us. One night, after a very real suicide attempt, I ended up in the psychiatric ward in Medicine Hat Regional Hospital, a place called Five North, and I stayed there for quite a long time. And living in the psych ward in that hospital for many months was the first time that I ever remember having this book in my hand. They had a copy of it at the hospital, and I shared about this yesterday, and you know, we joke about it and we have a laugh, but when I started reading this book, I went to page one, which meant I immediately started reading Bill's story. It also means that I missed like a whole bunch of some of the most important stuff in this book, man. I missed the doctor's opinion, I missed a whole bunch of the stuff about AA history, and I start reading about this guy named Bill. And one of the reasons why, for me, it's so important, you know, I facilitate a big book study every Monday night. Riley knows, he's been there, you know, every Monday night for 2 hours, every Monday night. And we've been doing that for probably 8 years now. Part of it is because I feel a huge debt to help people understand this book. Because sitting there alone in the psych ward with my brain's complete scrambled eggs, I could not make heads or tails of what this guy Bill was talking about. I had no idea what war he was talking about, what is a Hampshire Grenadier, who is Walter Hagen, the remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row and I became a lone wolf. What does that mean? I had no idea. I couldn't figure any of this out and I just became frustrated with it. But the only thing that they would let me out of the hospital for was to go to AA meetings. And so a fellow named Lonnie, and again, this is another example of someone else who came into my life at a particular time, and I didn't stay sober behind all this, but I remember this fellow named Lonnie coming to pick me up and take me to AA meetings. And he would come and he would sign me out of the hospital, and he was doing service work, you know, to a kid who was just absolutely turned upside down. And he would take me to these meetings, and you know, I remember he was only supposed to take me to the meetings, but once in a while we would break the rules and we would stop at Nifty 50's Cafe and he would buy me French fries and a milkshake before he'd take me back to the hospital. I'll never forget spending Christmas in 1998 in that psych ward. They would not let me out until I could get into a treatment center, and there wasn't one available at the time. And after New Year's that year, they had to move me in the hospital. I wasn't acute enough, but they didn't want me to leave yet. So I'm 19 years old, and they put me in a new place in the hospital. They actually put me in the palliative care unit, which is, I felt like I fit right in, you know, and that's how I was living at the time. So, you know, I left that psych ward, and I started probably one of the darkest periods of my entire life after that psych ward. I went to a treatment center, not AA-based treatment center, and that was a period of my life for that you know, 3 years. I started touring different treatment centers, and I started just going to a lot of meetings and completely missed the whole purpose of AA. And I didn't understand the point of having a sponsor, and I didn't understand these 12 steps, and I certainly did not understand whatsoever the importance of having a spiritual awakening and developing this relationship with God. And all I was doing for that period of my life was going to meetings and nothing else. And my understanding of AA at that point was that AA is like group therapy. That's the point. You go in, I talk about my stuff, I talk about my problems, and somehow I'm supposed to leave the meeting and feel better. And I didn't. And I would go home, and there was one point in my life I was going to like 5 AA meetings a day on the bus, just trying to stay sober and not want to kill myself. And it was just a very, very dark period in my life. And ultimately, you know, after many, many relapses, multiple different relapses, I called a treatment center that I had been to before. And I called them and I begged them. I don't want to get into the whole story about the last night that I drank, but it wasn't pretty. And I called them and I begged them, please let me into this treatment center again. I'll do anything. I'm desperate to get into this treatment center. And so I came down for the interview and they sent me home and they called me back and they said, we want you to know that we've agreed to let you back in the treatment center. I go, okay, great. And they said, we also want you to know that we took a vote amongst the counselors and the vote was not unanimous. Right? And that's because prior to being in that treatment center, I was dishonest, manipulative, obnoxious, very, very difficult client for them to have. There was no surrender whatsoever in me at that time. So I went back to that treatment center, and the counselors in that treatment center were always talking about, you need to get honest with yourself. You need to get honest with yourself. And finally, in desperation one day, I went back to that treatment, I went to the counselor's office rather, and said, I have no idea what you mean by that. What do you mean by that? Get honest with yourself. And they said, well, that's probably a good start. Coming here and asking us that question is probably a good start. And what they recommended, they said, Kevin, why don't you go up to your room and talk to God? Ask God to show you what's true. Ask God to show you the truth about you. And so I did. I went up to my room and I had remembered somebody one time talking about the power of praying on my knees. Instead of just talking to God, standing in the shower, like, God, are you there? No? All right, never mind. Right? Or praying while I'm, like, driving down the street, that kind of thing. And that's fine. I mean, if that's where I'm at, that's where I'm at. But for me, the first time that I got down on my knees to pray was one of my first real, true, genuine spiritual experiences. I was just talking to... Where's Corey Lynn? Corey Lynn, you going to try it?
No, I
am. Yeah. We were just talking about that. We were just talking about that this morning, right? What are some of the actions, just simple actions that I can take, that will make a difference? And for me, I got down on my knees in that treatment center, and I asked God to show me what was true. And for me, that was the first moment. What the book says is that we learned we had to concede to our innermost selves that we were truly alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And for me, in that moment on my knees in that treatment center, that was where I firmly and finally surrendered. Surrendered to... not just to alcoholism, not just to the problem, but I also surrendered to the solution. The three things that every alcoholic needs to know to understand in order to achieve recovery in AA. I need to know what the problem is, but I also need to know what the solution is. And I surrendered to the solution in that moment. I surrendered, I believe, to God in my own understanding in that moment. And the other thing that we need in order to achieve that solution is a program of action. Our program of action are the 12 steps. The 12 spiritual actions. And if you're new here today, let me please share something with you that was shared with me. Our 12 steps, that is Alcoholics Anonymous. That is what we have. Those 12 steps, everything that we have here comes as a result of those 12 steps. Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. See, I thought for years that what I needed to do was become spiritual so that I could do the steps. And I understand today that all I'm deciding to do in step 3, all I'm really deciding to do is that I want to have that spiritual awakening. I haven't had it yet. I talk in the big book study. It's like if I say I want to go to Las Vegas, does that mean I'm in Las Vegas? No, I'm just making a decision that I want to go to Las Vegas, but I've got a lot of work to do before I can get there. Okay, and the work that we do here is that program of action. It's those 12 steps. And for the first time, on my knees in that treatment center, I surrendered, not to the problem, but I surrendered to the solution. And to me, that is a far more important surrender for me to make. I surrendered to the solution, God as I understood him in that moment. And the other thing, like Corey Lynn and I were talking about, it's like, I don't need to understand God to make this beginning. You know, the two questions it asks in the chapter, We Agnostics. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe there is a power greater than myself? All I have to do is be willing and try and make that effort. And for me, sitting in that treatment center, that's where it happened for me. And I got very busy in AA immediately. I got a sponsor for the first time. I got a really good sponsor who was taking me through this work. And was willing to dedicate time to me, the time that I try to dedicate to my sponsees today as a way of, you know, paying back the debt that I've been given. And this sponsor took me through steps 4 and took me through step 5. And, you know, I remember, you know, level of willingness, like I didn't show up for my 5th step. I didn't call, I didn't show, completely no-showed on him. And I remember he came and tracked me down, right? And I'll never forget the phone call. He said, when are you going to try something other than your own self-will? And we went that afternoon, we did my 5th step for the first time, and I only had one rule for him. And some of you will understand what I'm talking about here. My only rule for him was that during the 5th step, under no circumstances was he to touch me in any way, no matter what. I had some stuff that I needed to talk about, and I needed to know that I was safe, and he just said, yeah, that's no problem. Right? And we did that 5th step, and my life changed from that moment on. I identified what my defects of character were. Selfishness, self-centeredness, and self-pity. You know, all the other defects I'm going to have are all going to stem from those basic things. Selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of my trouble. You know, I learned these things. I went through the amends process, and my father, you know, who's very important to me, took and received my amend right away. My mom, on the other hand, would not receive my amend until I was 4 years sober. I had to show a lot of change. I had to do a lot of things in order for her to be able to forgive me. And I remember the moment that it happened. I was 4 years sober, and it was about 3 a.m., and I got a phone call, and it was my mom, and she was sick in the middle of the night. And my dad was out of town, and she needed me to come pick her up and take her to the hospital. And I did. I couldn't have went faster. I couldn't have raced faster. I couldn't have loved her more in that moment and felt more honored to go take my little mom and take her down to the hospital. And we sat there in 8th and 8th Medical Clinic in the emergency clinic downtown, in downtown Calgary. And we started talking, and that's the moment. That's where, at 4 years of recovery, she allowed me to make a formal 9-step amend to her that night, and it was beautiful. I started getting involved in service work and 12-step work and sponsorship and all that stuff. Started actively, you know, taking new guys through the steps, and I developed a really, really, really strong relationship at that point with AA. I had a great relationship with AA, and I loved AA very, very much. And you know, I went back to university, I got my degree, I got a career, you know, things were going really, really well, and I was a good member of AA. And I met a woman. And I got into a relationship, right? And let me tell you what happened, man. You know, I'll tell you guys the story, and you're gonna think, like, oh, that sounds like a movie script, like, it wasn't a movie, man. It was my life. And I don't want no spoiler alerts, right? I'll tell you what happened. So we get, I fell in love. I mean, she was a lovely woman, and we fell in love, and things were great. And I was busy in AA doing the AA thing. And we got engaged, and we started to plan the wedding, and we booked the church, and we got her wedding dress, and we had engagement photos done, and the whole parents, we did marriage preparation courses, like everything was great, and I was madly in love with her, and started, you know, to probably slow down on some of the AA stuff that I was doing, because I was busy now, I had a life to live, you know. And she went on a business trip to Maui, and while she was in Maui, she met Charlie. Charlie the surf instructor. This is absolutely true story. She met Charlie the surf instructor, and she came home and she said, guess what? I've met the man of my dreams, and you're not it. The wedding is off. I don't want to know you or have anything to do with you anymore. You need to move out today, and that's it. And I was 6 years sober at that point, and I'd love to tell you that I handled that with spiritual grace, but I certainly did not. If you've ever seen a man die of a broken heart, that was me at that moment. The people in my home group were going to have an intervention on me just to get me to eat because I lost 30 pounds. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I was going absolutely insane. And while I'm going through all this, like, she's in Maui with him. And it was driving me just absolute madness. I remember taking my 6th birthday that year, standing up and taking my card or whatever at the birthday and just sobbing. There was nothing I could do because she's with him right now tonight in Maui, and I was just falling apart. And at this point in my life, I had developed a career in sales, and you can imagine that I was not functioning at peak business efficiency during this moment. So I lost my job. And on the day I lost my job, and she was in Maui with him, I thought, one of two things is going to happen today. I had been restored to sanity about alcoholism, but somewhere along the line, the idea of smoking a commodity, smoking a joint, came to mind. And I thought, I'm either going to smoke a joint tonight or I'm going to commit suicide. And I went out that night and smoked a joint. I went out and smoked a joint one night for 3 years, is what I did. And I didn't drink, but I did smoke marijuana for 3 years. And I smoked marijuana. I want you guys to know, I understand we have a singleness of purpose, and I don't mean to cross that boundary. I do want to assure you that when I smoke marijuana, I smoke it alcoholically. Like Bob D, our friend Bob D says, alcoholics should not do drugs. Okay? So listen, that's what happened. And you know, I had a lot of really good friends in AA who, they understood. They saw what I went through. They know what I was going through. The real reason I took that so hard, I know today, is because I had made her my higher power. See, the central fact of my life has got to be my recovery. And if I put anything ahead, if I let anything else get in the center of my life other than recovery in God, that thing will disappear when I get loaded again. And I see my sponsees doing it all the time. They'll put a relationship in the center and then wonder why their life falls apart. They'll put a job in the center, then understand, can't understand why their life falls apart. For me, when I put God and recovery, make that the central fact of my life, everything else that orbits around that center flourishes miraculously. The reason why I took that so hard, I know today looking back, because I did not react to it like, you know, there's a broken heart and like you go through a breakup. This was like, I was absolutely rocked, devastated. And it was because to me, it felt like God had left. Because I had made her the central fact of my life. So after 3 years of commodities, I came back to AA, and I had some very, very good friends who, they didn't judge me, they didn't push me, they just let me know that they were there and they were ready when I was ready to come back. And after 3 years, you know, my friend Warren, who's a member of my home group today, was the guy who took the call, and I came back to a meeting right away, and I came back to AA with a vengeance and an enthusiasm that I'd never had before. And I immediately got into what's called a Back to Basics Step Action Series. And that Back to Basics Step Action Series, we went through all the 12 steps in 1 month. One hour a week, we went through all the 12 steps very rapidly. I did another fifth step, another fourth step, and another fifth step. And as you can imagine, a lot of the fifth step was surrounded around that relationship. And I want to tell you a story about that. One of the things that I resented very most at that time was this SUV that we had. because I had bought an SUV with her, and we bought it together, and we co-signed on the loan, and then when I had to get her name off the loan, I had to get it refinanced, and it was going to be like another $10,000 this SUV was going to cost me as a result of it, and the SUV just reminded me of her, and I felt I would never be able to get away from it, and the whole thing, right? So on my fourth step, literally in column one, I wrote the word, like, SUV. It's right there. SUV. What am I mad at? SUV. Why? Right? Write it all down. Did the whole thing. So I go do this fifth step, and it was great, and, you know, with my sponsor, Adam, at the time. And we did the fifth step, and there's some tears, and Adam says, well, let's go for breakfast. We say, sure. So we walk out the front door, and the door's open, and I see there's police sirens and lights everywhere. Which, by the way, is not something you want to see when you walk out of doing a fifth step. And I look and I see that these sirens and these lights, these police cars, are all surrounded my SUV. And then I look and I see that all these police lights and sirens are actually surrounding what used to be my SUV. Because while I was inside doing the fifth step about this SUV, there had been an accident outside. A guy texting on his phone had driven, hit my SUV, and accordioned it underneath the car in front of it. The SUV was a complete write-off. He was fine, the driver, and that SUV was gone. Insurance bought me a new car, and I never had to drive that SUV again. True story. Absolutely true story. It's amazing. So, about that time, I went on a business trip to Las Vegas. And I went to Las Vegas and I went to an AA meeting in Las Vegas called the Specific Group, which at that time was Bob Darrell's home group. And I'd never seen an AA meeting like that before. It absolutely blew my mind. Everyone there was incredibly enthusiastic, incredibly dedicated, and they had like a list of people lined up to get on service positions, and there was a respect there for AA that I'd never seen before, and the meeting was well controlled, and it was just lit up on fire. And one of the things, they had a 3-minute timer. All the speakers got exactly 3 minutes to share, and no more, and that was it. And they cut you off mid-sentence. And I had an incredibly profound experience at that meeting. There was a community there of people, unlike anything that I had personally seen in AA before. It was really, truly mesmerizing. And I came back and got with that fellow Adam I just mentioned and the fellow Warren, and we got together, and I really felt dedicated. I really felt a fire inside that we needed to do something similar to what I had just seen down in Las Vegas. I was absolutely inspired. And so we wrote a little meeting format. And we started a meeting in Calgary called the Primary Purpose Group. And we started that meeting on a Tuesday night, actually, at that time. And there was four of us, and we brought three guys from a homeless shelter. And we had a little meeting down in the basement of this church, and we started this meeting. And you know, there's a line in the book, to watch a fellowship grow about you and to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. Last Wednesday, we've been having that meeting now for about 10 years. Last Wednesday, we had 110 people. And I've been privileged and to have been a part of watching this meeting grow. And I'll tell you what, I people ask, like, how did it grow? Why did it grow? I know exactly why it grew. Because we focus on the solution in this book and nothing else. We read from this book, we share about what we've read in that book, and that is it. We have a podium meeting at the last Wednesday of every month, but we are dedicated to sponsorship and to this book. And there's a feeling there, there's a vibe that you get there that I had, you know, that I had when I came in here yesterday. It was beautiful, you know, and so I've been privileged to watch this meeting grow and to be a part of that. We just started a new thing. We're always trying new things at my group. We like to do things a little bit different. We read the original manuscript of how it works, right? We have a 3-minute timer. Nobody in Calgary has a meeting with a 3-minute timer, right? And we just started doing this this thing where we give away now stickers for steps taken at the end of the meeting instead of early milestone chips for recovery. So instead of 30, 60, 90 days, if you did, you know, your first 12-step call, you did your first 9-step amend, you did your first 5th step, you did your first 4th step, or if you just had a new experience with doing that, that's what we've recognized. We're just trying that. We just started that this month. We're trying it. So far, people love it. So far, it's an amazing thing. So we started this primary purpose group, and it's been an amazing thing to be a part of. And I just want to tell you a little bit about what my life is like today. I'm in sales. I worked for a professional organization, a major publicly traded company. And a couple of weeks ago, it's still like astounding to me. You know, Riley and I were talking about promotions and getting promoted at work. I just got promoted to a management role where now I have a team of engineers like reporting to me, and I'm not an engineer. And it's all I know to do in that scenario, number one is to pray and meditate a lot. I've been meditating a lot more recently. And, you know, for anyone who like me for a while, I was very, biased against meditation. You know, my sponsor and I were talking about step 11. He said, how's your step 11? I said, well, the prayer is great. You know, every morning, every day on my knees, like, no problem. I like that. And he said, okay, great. What about meditation? I said, well, I'm not... You know, I don't really like meditation. I don't do very much of it. And he said, oh, I see. So for you, step 11 says sought through prayer and or meditation. I see. Yeah, it's optional, right? So I've started meditating a lot more recently. And I'll tell you that informs everything that I do at work. My emotional tone and who I am and how I behave at work and how I react and how I don't react. Because I'll tell you, alcoholism, I have watched alcoholism in my recovery, in my sobriety, cause just as much pain and chaos as I ever did when I drank. You know? By the things that I've said to people. I've destroyed relationships, I've destroyed career opportunities, I've done all that, and I've done all that sober. I've seen it happen to me. And so I need to continually work these steps and continually work this program, continually work steps 11, particularly in my life. And so a lot of the meditation that I've been doing has been very, very helpful and instrumental at work. The other thing I need to know about work and how to, you know, get through that is just to show up. I really believe that like 90% of life is just show up, you know, no matter how I feel, you know. I have learned that all of the treasures and riches of life are just on the other side of a wall of fear. And I have to break through the wall of fear with God's help to get to the good stuff on the other side. And yeah, there are scary moments. I'll tell you what, this is scary. It was scary to me this morning when I woke up. It's a scary thing. But I know today that I have to get through the wall of fear to get to the good stuff on the other side of that wall. And so that's kind of what I'm going through at work a little bit. And then something that I never, ever, ever thought was going to happen to me ever again has happened. I met a woman. and she came into my home group a little while ago, and we met. And you know, it's amazing to me. You know, we talk about alcoholism and having to that sobriety is not the answer to alcoholism. That sobriety, in fact, was my attempted solution to my sobriety problem. Alcohol was my attempted solution to my living problem. And this gal, her name is Nikki, came into our group. She was 11 years sober, and she'd never had a sponsor, and she'd never worked the steps. And she was going to about a meeting a year, and she was absolutely dying of untreated alcoholism at 11 years sober. And it has been absolutely an absolute blessing in my life to see her and watch her blossom as some of the women in my home group came and took her and picked her up and helped her and lifted her up to the Spirit of God through the 12 steps and watch what has happened in her life. And I stayed away for a while, of course, right? And I talked with my guys and I talked with my sponsor, and we, you know, agreed when would be like an appropriate time for me to go, you know, get to know her a little bit, and you know, one thing led to another, and I never, ever, ever in my life imagined that I would ever fall in love again, or ever trust someone again, or ever be able to move into with someone again. And Nikki and I just moved in together back in July, and so far it's beautiful. I can't even describe it. You know, she has her sponsor, I have my sponsor. I've started going to Al-Anon. I was talking with Norma earlier. You know, I took a coworker of mine to an Al-Anon meeting a little while ago because he needed help. You see. And that's the only reason I ever would have went to an Al-Anon meeting, right? Because I'm fine, right? I'm fine. But he needed help. And like I told Norma, I went to that Al-Anon meeting, and as soon as they started talking, I started crying, right? I started crying at this Al-Anon meeting in the middle of my lunch hour during a work day. It was awful, right? And I was crying because of stuff that Nikki was going through and stuff that I was going through because of Nikki. And you know, I have a cousin. My cousin Blair is a horrible, 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 horrible drug addict and a horrible, horrible, horrible alcoholic. Like one of the worst that I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot. And I don't have any brothers or sisters, and Blair is about as close to a brother as I've ever had. And he was causing real havoc with my mom because my mom is real worried about what's happening with Blair, and Blair's drunk, 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 and he's just an unbelievable story. And I'm at this Al-Anon meeting, and I'm crying about Blair, and I'm crying about Nikki, and it's an amazing thing. And Al-Anon has been very, very helpful for me, and it's been helpful for my father as well. And I'd like to tell you as well that Blair is now 9 months sober, and Blair is starting his own meeting in Vernon, British Columbia. He's already down. It's an amazing thing. So, you know, when you walk into Nikki and my place too, I want you guys to know one of the first things you'll see is a big book sitting there right in the corner. We have a little stand, and we wanted that to be a primary importance in our home, because it's the primary purpose of both of our lives. And, you know, it's okay. And one thing I can tell you for sure is that Nikki is not my higher power. Nor would she ever allow me to be. And if she ever thought for a second that I was going that direction, she'd have my sponsor on the phone. I swear to you, like that, you know. And I've learned in Al-Anon, you know, when things are wrong, I didn't cause it. You know, I can't control it and I can't cure it. Right? Nikki has her own deal going on, and I have to take care of myself. That's it. I've learned these things, you know, and there's still lots and lots to learn. And I want to close. I'm going to read one more part again on page 25. This is my favorite part in the book. And I want to thank you guys, you know, before I read this, I want to thank you so much for having me here. I want to thank Riley for thinking of me. You know, Riley, I want to tell you, man, I've sponsored, as you know, like I'm privileged and grateful. I you know, I'm not special, but I work with a lot of people. I sponsor a lot of men. And there are many failures, but there are an occasional heartening success. And Riley, I want to thank you in my life for being one of those heartening successes. Don't get me wrong, like, he's still a loser. But he's doing good. He's doing good, man. He's doing good. This is page 25 in the book. The great fact is just this and nothing less. That we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. Thank you very much.